We have a very special show coming up with three experts to give us the latest news, tips, resources and accurate information on what's happening right now with the COVID-19 crisis. And we will be taking your calls and emails. You can email questions to dj@kgnu.org. I'm Maeve Conran and I am delighted to have three guests joining us. Catherine Shives, who holds a PhD in microbiology from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. She currently works for Sartorius Virus Analytics and she has a lot of experience in biological safety and looking at viruses. It's great to have you with us this evening, Catherine. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, Matt McQueen, who is the director of the Public Health Program and an associate professor in integrative physiology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Thank you, Matt, for jumping on into the show at the last minute. We appreciate your participation.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
And Lolly Gardner is an experienced certified biological safety professional. And we are delighted to have Lolly back on KGNU. Lolly and Catherine have both been guests in the last week. Welcome back to KGNU, Lolly.
Thank you for having me.
And I would like to recognize our friends and colleagues at the Boulder Bookstore. Originally, when we planned this forum, it was to be a live event broadcast from the Boulder Bookstore, given the recent decisions in the past week by Governor Polis to limit opportunities where large groups of people can come together. We have moved it indoors and we have it here at the studio with everybody joining us by phone. Well, we're going to touch on a lot of different issues. This is something that is moving so quickly and all of you have expertise in various different areas. Matt, I'll start with you as somebody who can maybe talk about public health and really Lolly or Catherine, either of you can jump in too. This issue of testing, we have been hearing all week that we do not have enough testing capacity in the state of Colorado. There's a lag time in people getting test results. But at the same time, we're also hearing from public health officials that we can extrapolate from the numbers that we have that there are so many more exponentially people who are infected with the coronavirus here in Colorado. So why is there such a focus on testing if or could we just imagine that loads and loads of people, thousands and thousands of people are already infected? Why do public health officials need to have that testing data?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first answer to that is, you know, I think testing is optimal very early on when you're dealing with an epidemic or an outbreak. And that allows us to really understand, right, when kind of the introduction of a particular infectious agent has occurred. The lag and the delay in the testing results and just the capacity to conduct these tests, really do keep one hand kind of tied behind our back in terms of knowing what, kind of where clusters might be, where, a particular person who may be infected who, for example, we've seen some tragic stories about somebody who works at a hospital, a healthcare facility, long-term care facility, knowing that, right, we really need to keep people like that who have tested positive to isolate and to not potentially infect people who are vulnerable. In an ideal world, we would, testing would be routinely available, easily done. Everyone would have one. We don't live in that world. So I think, the state and federal agencies are doing the best they can to keep up with that. And so modeling does take over, unfortunately. We have to kind of fill in the gaps to understand, what the extent is. I just heard an hour or two ago that in California they're, projecting, half of the population in the state of California will likely be infected. And again, these are all models. We don't know how it's going to come out, but that would obviously be determined without testing because we certainly don't have the capacity to test the entire state of California.
Well, if we were to look at either other states or indeed other countries that we could say are maybe a week to 2 weeks ahead of us in terms of where they are dealing with the coronavirus, of course, everybody is watching Italy and the extreme measures that have been taken now. But is it too little too late, given how widespread the coronavirus is in Italy? The measures that they have now where people are essentially on lockdown, is that even going to prove to be effective given the broad community spread that they're already experiencing?
Yeah, another really important question. I think, you know, my you know, there's sort of the testing issue, and then there's what we all can do to really kind of control, right, the environment which the agent is likely to spread. So, you know, the world, as you said, the world is really watching Italy. We're looking to Italy, obviously, our society, in terms of, you know, free movement of people, the structure of the economy and so on, you know, looks most similar to what we have in the United States. But, you know, the important thing is, right, there's been really, really strong examples from not only South Korea, even where this all started within the region of China, within Wuhan, that this actually works, the social distancing, these extreme measures. Again, it feels extreme, right? We can go outside, we can walk around, everything looks normal, people are talking and smiling, right? But this is the window we're in, this 2-week window, where we really dictate how steep this curve gets and ultimately how quickly we reach its peak, which is obviously the goal. So everything that people are doing, as disruptive as it is to their lives, right, we've seen it work with other epidemics and pandemics. We're seeing it work with this particular agent as well. As hard as it is, I think that if we keep this going for a little while longer, we will be able to be effective. So the world is watching Italy, for sure.
Well, of course, everybody is looking for some type of time frame. And of course, nobody can actually have that. But if we were to then maybe look ahead to China, which I think has had no reported cases of COVID-19 from within China, I think any new cases have been people who have been traveling. Is there a way to estimate, you know, how this curve might play out with the current conditions that we're going through here in Colorado?
Yeah, in Colorado, and again, Katie, others on the, please chime in. I certainly not the only expert on this. I think there's a lot of finger crossing. There's a lot of, you know, sort of hopefulness with our response. How things play out. Why the world, you know, much of the world that's just now acquiring infections like the United States, as we're really on the kind of epidemic phase of the curve, are looking to Italy is because we want to see if what they've done, which is, you know, to a certain extent, what we're doing in large parts of the United States, you know, how effective that will be and how long from the implementation of these distancing strategies will essentially, you know, offset, right, the sort of the peak of this curve. There are early indications. Again, I think it's too early to declare any kind of success with Italy, but there are some indications that they've entered what they call the linear phase, which means they're not, you know, they don't have a series of exponential growth, and which means that, again, some infectious disease experts I'm listening to from Italy are hopeful that sometime next week, they'll start to hit the peak of the curve. In that case, depending upon the structures, you know, I know New York City has unique challenges, you know, with just the size of population and hospital beds and so on. Within Colorado, I've been impressed with the state's response, with Governor Polis's response, which initially seemed kind of forceful and swift. But I think we actually have a good chance here in Colorado, to really flatten the peak earlier. Than maybe we would have if we just kind of kept on rolling with business as usual.
That's Matt McQueen, who's the director of the public health program at CU Boulder. He's also an associate professor in integrative physiology. Also joining us, Lolly Gardner and Catherine Shives. And I'd like to bring you both in now. Catherine, what is it about the coronavirus that makes it so widespread, that is really causing such a reaction globally?
Well, before we settled on the new designation of COVID-19. This virus was originally referred to as the novel coronavirus. It may seem like quite a while ago, but this was just back in January. And it's called a novel virus because no one in the human population has ever seen this virus before. So no one has any sort of pre-existing immunity to these types of viruses. which means that it's very easy for this virus to transmit within the community because you don't have people that are immune and therefore don't get infected and don't transmit. So when we talk about vaccination, we talk about the concept of herd immunity, where we have enough people who are immune to something that it really prevents that disease, whether it's a virus or bacteria, from spreading effectively from person to person. But because no one has any sort of pre-existing immunity to the coronavirus, it's able to spread very effectively within communities. And also building on Matt's point about flattening the curve and limiting the spread, we actually have some really interesting data from the 1917-1918 flu pandemic from Denver. And that was where we had an initial spike in cases, but then they instituted social distancing and quarantine measures, which effectively reduced those cases that were occurring. But then they relaxed them, and then there was a second wave. And this is because it was a novel virus, and they still hadn't, even after the first wave of infections, made it to a level of full herd immunity within the community, and so the virus was able to spread again. And so this is something that we're going to have to watch very closely with China. I know that they have reports that, you know, in the last day there have been zero reported new cases, which is excellent news and really a testament to how much effort was put into their social distancing and their testing and their treatment programs. It really is quite stunning work that was accomplished there. But now the challenge is making sure that it doesn't become reintroduced to the community and cause new hotspots of infection. The one benefit going into the second round is that now we do have much more effective surveillance and testing, and we know what symptoms to look for, and so we'll hopefully be able to prevent a secondary surge in areas that have already been through infection.
Now, we'll talk about vaccines in a moment, but is there any sense that if you have gotten an initial infection of COVID-19 that you would have any type of immunity, or could you be hit equally as hard if you were to get infected a second or even third time?
So it's fairly hard to know at this point. We do know that right now there are four other endemic coronaviruses, and so that means coronaviruses that circulate within the population. They cause a really mild cold. That's why they've never really been a major public health issue. They don't cause severe disease, but it's been shown that you can get them over time as your immunity from the first infection wanes. There's also some data that shows that some people may have reinfection or that they may test positive again after testing negative. But it's really, until we get more data, it's too hard to say. In most cases, after infection, you do have some level of immunity and circulating antibodies that will be protective. And so for now, we're really hoping that that is how it plays out with this new virus as well.
And for you as a researcher, Catherine, and Lolly as well as a researcher, is this helpful now to have had people who have had it and have recovered? Are they helpful in the search for a vaccine?
In this case, yes. So if you have antibodies that are effective at controlling this infection, those are of very high interest to people developing therapies, because these are antibodies that are proven to work, so it helps shorten the discovery period when you know this is something that, in a person, it's protective and able to control the infection. So acquiring samples from people who have successfully recovered from a known diagnosed case will definitely be helpful moving forward.
That's Catherine Shives, who's a microbiologist. She's currently working for Sartorius Virus Analytics as research and development scientist, and she's a biological safety officer as well. I'd like to bring in our other guest, Lolly Gardner, who's an experienced certified biological safety professional. Lolly, I know that you have been doing numerous forums like this, so we're very grateful for your participation this evening. And once again, I would like to recognize our partners at the Boulder Bookstore, who had originally organized this forum. We moved it away from the bookstore because of the restrictions that have been imposed this week. I know many of the questions you've been getting at these forums, how to protect myself, what are the symptoms? But I know people are also asking, when will a vaccine be available? And there's a lot of misinformation, maybe rumours that are out there. Lolly, can you give us some kind of accurate idea of when a vaccine might actually be available?
Sure. So vaccines generally take 12 to 18 months to develop in billions of dollars. You know, there are vaccine trials that started yesterday. We're hopeful that the vaccine will be available to the public within the next 9 to 12 months. Depending on, you know, how the vaccine trials go, that could be available at some time.
Well, I know one of the other questions that many people are asking you at these forums that you're doing is, what are the symptoms and could I have this and not necessarily know? So what are the symptoms, as much as we can tell, of COVID-19?
So the symptoms of COVID-19 include a fever, a dry cough, and shortness of breath. This is a lower respiratory virus, so unlike the upper respiratory viruses that we're more familiar with, where we get a runny nose, sneezing or kind of a wet cough. This is a little bit different, but most people are reporting a fever first, then a cough, and then sometimes in a little less than, 30% of the population, that shortness of breath.
I know one of the challenges is that many people are not symptomatic and could still be carriers. Take us through that and then the challenges that that presents.
True. So, you know, disease manifests itself in individuals differently. We are having some reports that there are people who are asymptomatic that are infectious with the COVID-19. And that presents a problem because if somebody's asymptomatic, they don't have any symptoms at all. So they may be out visiting with friends or going to the grocery store or just, you know, doing things that they need to do to kind of live in this new COVID-19 environment. So when somebody is asymptomatic, it does present a problem. Matt probably experiences it more with the public health side of things, where it's harder to control the disease transmission at that point.
What is the best way then for people to protect themselves? And we'll get into, and we've already touched on the idea of social distancing and indeed social isolation. But if people have to be out and about, what is the best way for them to protect themselves?
Right. So always staying your 6 feet away from somebody else is a good way to protect yourself when you're out and having to move around. Also washing your hands. I wash my hands as soon as I get out of the car. I sanitize my hands as soon as I get out of the car before I touch anything. Like in a grocery store or any place that I need to visit, I sanitize my hands first. And then as I'm going through the movements of grocery shopping or getting medication, I'm constantly washing my hands with hand sanitizer until I leave that place of business, and then I can go home and I can wash my hands with soap and water. We know that about 80% of disease transmission with the flu virus can be reduced if you wash your hands more than 5 times a day. So washing your hands is the best way an individual can take care of themselves during this pandemic.
And let's break that down as to why and where the virus lives. If you are practicing distancing and you're not within 6 feet of people, you can still acquire the virus on your hands if you're touching things. So where can the virus reside outside of, you know, getting sneezed or coughed on and having droplets, you know, contaminate you? Where else are you being exposed?
So, you know, our hands are dirty. We're touching things that are dirty. The virus and bacteria like our fingernails. You know, there are little crevices in there. So fingernails, the back of the hand, the thumbs are places that we often miss when we're washing our hands. So paying special attention to those areas when we're washing them can decrease your disease transmission.
We've had several people contact us through the day. We've been inviting emails and a lot of people really asking a variation on this question. If you're out and about and you don't have access to hand washing, maybe you're out hiking, maybe you're doing something. And what then can you do to protect yourself? You mentioned hand sanitizer. Is that as effective as washing your hands? What does hand sanitizer do?
Well, washing your hands with soap and water is always the best way to clean your hands. If soap and water are not available, using a hand sanitizer that's at least 60% alcohol can be an alternative to getting your hands clean. So, if, you know, washing your hands, soap and water, using hand sanitizer, if that's not available, is an option.
Is there a sense of how long a virus could live on a hard surface, like a door, like a handle, like a light switch, all of the things that we touch throughout the day, not just in our homes, but then if we are out and about in a grocery store, if we touch the handle of a shopping cart, how long is all of this living on these surfaces?
So we do have a couple studies that show that the virus lives on fabric for 2 to 3 hours. It lives on skin a couple of hours, and then its longest survival is on steel, metal, and plastics, and that's about 2 to 3 days. So if we're out moving around at the grocery store and we're touching things, the best way to prevent the transmission is just to wash your hands as soon as you leave the store. A lot of stores have hand sanitizer available for you when you walk in and when you walk out. I keep hand sanitizer in the car, so I wash my hands in the car with the hand sanitizer, and then when I get home, I wash my hands again with soap and water.
And then just, I suppose, the related question is, for touching your face, if you have touched a surface that potentially has the virus on it, and then you touch somewhere on your face, how is that then going into your body?
You know, the virus is transmitted through your mucosal membranes in your nose. So, you know, keeping your hands away from your nose, but if you happen to touch your nose or your mouth, you should wash those areas that you've touched with your hands. Use soap and water. Please do not use bleach or alcohol.
But
soap and water is fine.
And soap and water has been effective because of the actual structure of the virus itself. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I'm not a chemist, so I don't understand the bonds of soap and how it reacts with the virus. Maybe somebody else on the call is a little bit better versed in that. But you know, soap does, you know, washing your hands with water is fine, but really it's the soap and the action of friction in your hands and then the rinsing of the soap and water off into the drain.
One of the questions we did get emailed by a listener was then, what about jewelry rings? Do they harbor, are they crevices? Should we stop wearing jewelry on our hands then as a potential for harboring the virus?
I don't know that. I don't know if I don't really have an answer for that. Washing them, I noticed that my rings are really beautiful now because I've been washing them so much. So, you know, they do get washed in the soap and waters, you know, in the alcohol that you're using. So does somebody else have a better answer than that?
Lolly or Matt, anybody have an answer as to jewelry, whether that's an issue with the virus, maybe contamination of jewelry?
I would say as long as you're making sure that the soap is really getting into all of those crevices and surfaces, that if you're wearing rings, you move the ring, you wash under the ring, and then resit it. What's really important about soap, and it doesn't have to be antibacterial soap, just any good lathering soap, is the way that soap works against this virus is surrounded by what is essentially a fatty membrane. And soap breaks that apart, and it renders the virus non-infectious. It is no longer a danger to anyone because the soap breaks it down at a molecular level. It's pretty interesting. It's sort of like when you add dish soap to your sink and you see the oil on top move and break apart, doing the same thing to the virus. And so as long as you're getting really clean, I would recommend at this point in time wearing a lot of jewelry. A lot of hand washing can actually be damaging to your jewelry over time. But as long as you're really getting into everything, getting underneath it, and really making sure that it's fully clean, so it would be sort of along the lines of when you're cleaning your nails and making sure that you're getting under your nails, a check of getting under and doing your jewelry as well. So as long as you're really getting in there and everything's fully lathered, I think that should be sufficient to ensure that you're essentially decontaminating your hands sufficiently to feel confident that you're not carrying virus.
I want to let listeners know that they're tuned in to Community Radio KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and we're holding an informational roundtable with three experts in this area. We are talking, of course, about COVID-19 with Catherine Shives, who's a microbiologist. She's working right now for Sartorius Virus Analytics. She's a research and development scientist, but she's also a biological safety officer and has worked a lot in virology. Also joining us, Matt McQueen, who's a director of public health program at CU Boulder, an associate professor there of integrative physiology. And our third guest is Lolly Gardner, who's an experienced certified biological safety professional. And we're talking about all aspects of COVID-19. And we're inviting your participation. If you have a question, you can email us at dj@kgnu.org, dj@kgnu.org. Or you can call us now at 303-442-4242. This forum was originally planned by our friends at the Boulder Bookstore, and it was to take place live at the bookstore with a live remote broadcast on KGNU. For obvious reasons and for everything that has happened this week, we are doing it by phone, but we still welcome your participation. The fact that a week ago we were actually considering having an event at the bookstore and how quickly everything has changed is a real indicator of how quick things are changing exponentially. Do you think, are we ahead or behind the curve in how we're tackling what's happening here in Colorado?
I've been impressed with the response. It's something that no one is ever quite prepared for. I mean, it's something, you know, we're typically used to reacting to things that happen and not really getting out in front of things, right? And I think, Dr. Fauci of the NIH put it very, if you enjoy, sport analogies, talking about, in a hockey analogy, skating to where the puck will be, not where the puck currently is in a hockey setting. And I think that's a challenge, right? Because you have to try to convince the public that, hey, listen, we really need to get out in front of this without really any evidence, even before there's even a case that's been diagnosed in your community. As I said before, I really am impressed with the steps that Colorado have taken. These are not easy decisions. To close ski season right before spring break, to the Boulder has postponed into the fall. These are major decisions that have occurred that will have economic consequences and so on. So in doing so, right, they've really helped us and given, I think, our public health a chance to get on top of this. So the steps that we've taken, they look good. Again, the models that I've seen from people I trust on this matter, I do think that Colorado, is in a good position with this. It doesn't mean that we put our guard down. Of course, we have to keep doing what we're doing. And again, only time will tell, how well we've performed. And again, just, a comment on that, if we end up kind of keeping it tapped down, right, there'll be a lot of criticism that says, well, this wasn't that bad. Why did we do all these things and so on? And I think every epidemiologist and public health, official would welcome that type of criticism that we overreacted to something like this. So I do think that Colorado, I've been impressed with Colorado's response. I've been impressed with how Boulder County, the city, has responded to this. It seems to me from just, kind of anecdotally that people are taking this very seriously. University of Colorado as well. These are very difficult decisions they've had to make. And I think we need to really, applaud, their efforts to really put the public, public health as a priority.
Well, to that end, before we go to our listeners, we have listeners calling in. What does success look like in Colorado when it comes to battling COVID-19? I mean, is it looking like nobody here would have it, everybody's cured? I mean, what does success look like with this kind of public health issue?
Oh, boy. And Katie Lolly, please chime in as well. Success, my level of anxiety will drop a bit when I start to see this moving to when this moves towards, more of a linear increase in cases, eventually starting to look more of logarithmic, where we start to move down the other side of the curve. The problem is, as we're seeing in Italy, you know, oftentimes what we define as kind of a successful intervention still is on the backdrop of very devastating and tragic news. For, you know, Italy is experiencing their highest, you know, kind of number of deaths right now, which is expected given the, you know, kind of the lag time between diagnosed cases and then eventual complications that lead to something as tragic as a fatal outcome. So it's, you know, there's no one's going to be celebrating. You know, I think success would be that we start to see that we round the corner with this. And if you think about just very, you know, conceptually, just think about moving over this curve that we're all on. We're on a very steep exponential curve right now. As soon as that moves to more of a linear curve, we start to flatten out and starts to look downhill. That is success, even though, right, there'll be great individual, you know, loss and tragedies that will follow that. And then eventually, right, you know, we start to, I don't think it'll be a flip of a switch where everybody goes back to what they were doing before. It'll probably be scaled and partitioned out where, you know, maybe we get kids, you know, K through 12 schools back, you know, up and running. Maybe then we start opening restaurants and so on. So I don't think it's going to be any particular moment that we clap our hands and declare the war is over. It's going to be a slow process, but I think eventually we'll start to you know, what we see will start to look and feel a little more normal.
Well, I'd like to welcome a caller to the airwaves. We've got Marty calling in. Marty, you're live on KGNU this evening. What's your question?
Great. Thanks so much, Maeve. I actually have two questions. They're a little different, so I'll just quickly put them both out there. The first has to do with wearing masks, and I know everything says, oh, no, you don't need a mask unless you're sick or taking care of someone who is sick. And it's just intuitively that doesn't feel right to me, even if it's not one of the healthcare worker masks. It just feels, I think, obviously we see in Asian countries a much broader use of masks, and intuitively it feels like that would provide some protection. So that's my first question. And the second one has to do with the vaccine, which I know is, you know, a year or so out. But the current flu vaccines feel like a hit or miss. And, in fact, when we have viruses and we go to the doctor, what I've heard my whole life is, well, it's a virus and there's nothing we can do. So I'm very curious as to how this would be different and if there actually could be a vaccine for a virus such as this. Those are my questions.
Great questions, Marty. We will get them answered for you. That idea of masks, and this comes up a lot. Lolly, maybe you could answer this one. Is it worth wearing a mask? We're being told that it's not, and yet at the same time, that does seem counterintuitive.
Well, a face mask is not meant to protect you from aerosols. It's meant to protect the person who's sick from dispersing aerosols. So a face mask doesn't sit tight against your face, giving you the protection that you need. So we're asking people not to wear a face mask because they need to go to people who are sick in the healthcare system. And they're not working. They don't work the way we would think they work. They give us a false sense of protection. The type of mask that would be appropriate would be N95. They're in short supply. Again, there's not reason for us to wear it unless we're taking care of somebody that's sick or if we're in the healthcare system. We should really leave those items to people who are at higher risk and are facing the COVID virus every day. So we should really not be taking those out of circulation. However, the CDC did say today that wearing a bandana would be fine. And in some cases, because we don't have enough supplies for our medical society, they may also be starting to wear bandanas. So that's something you have at home that you have at your own disposal or a piece of cloth that would be a better option if you feel that you need to have something, but it doesn't necessarily protect you from getting COVID.
Well, before we move on to Marty's question about vaccines, I mean, I've had my own questions about masks in terms of when you're wearing one. I mean, it's stopping you at least from touching your nose and mouth. So maybe it's even effective in that regard, given what we've been talking about in terms of don't touch your face.
Right. That is true. Sometimes I've noticed that people adjust quite a bit. So they're probably touching their face even more than they would if they didn't have one on. And then some people just simply aren't wearing them correctly. They need to cover both your mouth and your nose. And I've seen several times people pulling it down over their nose and only protecting their mouth, or taking it off to talk or eat. I think it's going to give a false sense of protection if you're not using it correctly. And you're not used to using it.
Okay, well, before we move on to other callers, Marty's second question was around vaccine efficacy and the fact that, you know, very often the flu vaccine that is launched every flu season is not effective in every case. I mean, what's the efficacy of this?
I think I can answer this one. So influenza virus and coronavirus are very, very different types of viruses, and therefore the vaccine approach is going to be quite different. So this is a novel coronavirus. This is one species of virus that is currently circulating. So it's a single target. And this makes it different from the flu, which is a virus that has been with humanity for quite some time now and exists as multiple strains. Now, with the seasonal flu vaccine, it is usually formulated with two or three different flu strains based off of what was circulating the prior year. And as a result, because there are so many different flu strains in circulation, it may be that what comes in the next year is not necessarily what was in the formulation. But that vaccine is still effective for a certain percentage of flu cases, and is able to reduce transmission, is able to reduce the severity of disease, and it is effective for a large proportion of the population. Coronavirus, this is a single virus. And so what you would want to do here is you would vaccinate, and it will give you that protection and it will prevent the spread. Now, speaking to the comment of when you go to a doctor's office and you have a viral infection and they say, well, there's nothing we can give you, that's the whole purpose of vaccines. So we want to give vaccines to prevent that disease in the first place, because as we hopefully all know by now, antibiotics are for bacteria, and they're not effective against viruses. And so vaccines exist to prevent this infection entirely up front, or at the very least, to provide a certain level of protection to reduce the severity and the duration of the disease, which even reducing severity and duration and reducing transmission in a situation like we're seeing with COVID-19 can be really critical to public health overall.
Well, Marty, thanks for your call this evening. We have several other calls to get through. I want to remind listeners that this is KGNU. We're speaking this evening with Catherine Shives, who's a microbiologist, Matt McQueen, Director of Public Health, the Public Health Program at CU Boulder, an Associate Professor in Integrative Physiology, and Lolly Gardner, Certified Biological Safety Professional. And of course, we're speaking about COVID-19. We'll go back to the phones. We'll welcome Robert. You're live on KGNU this evening.
Well, thank you. I've been taking in lots of news, being at home a lot, of course, and I'm just very surprised that it seems the way that viruses are transmitted is not really getting across very clearly, and actually a lot of confused information. Even such a phrase as touching your face, as far as I know, viruses don't go through healthy skin well or at all. I hope you can comment on that in a minute. But, you know, if you touch your forehead, your cheeks, your chin with the virus, probably still not going to get it, not that it's a good idea to do. And these type of viruses don't typically go through stomach very well either. So touching, you know, getting it in your mouth, swallowing it, I hope you comment on that. I don't think it's a good vector. And directly to blood, virus to blood, like if you have a cut or a sore, or you have compromised conditions in your throat or mouth, perhaps the virus goes to bloodstream. I'm not sure, but I know that as far as I know, the very main way the virus is transmitted is through the air into your throat, into your nasal passages, into your lungs, and the virus plants itself in one of those three places. And this is mostly lungs, as you think you pointed out. And so it's mostly what's going into our lungs through the air. And to me, this is why face masks were worn everywhere in China and Korea. And now the CDC is saying even anything is better than nothing. And I just think that it's amazing that we haven't gone to face masks right away of some kind or another, because protecting, the nose and mouth from the air is the most effective way, along, yes, of course, hand washing and not putting things in your mouth and eyes and nose. So that's about it.
Okay, Robert, thanks for your call. Well, we'll let our guests answer that. This idea of touching your face, I mean, we have talked about it's your mucous membranes, your nose and your eyes and around your mouth that you're most impacted by the virus coming in. So why are we just saying touching your face as being an issue?
Well, I think the big thing here is to comment on these viruses. So viruses don't go through normal skin, like, say, on your arm or your foot or something like that. And that's because the structure of the skin there is built to keep things out. That's why it's our outer covering. It keeps us safe and protected from the environment. Where it starts to get different are, as Wally mentioned, your mucous membranes. So the soft, moist tissue around your eyes, inside your nose, your throat, inside your mouth. These cells don't have that same level of protection. And so when the virus contacts that cell, it is able to get inside the cell and start to make copies of itself. Once it starts making copies of itself, a couple hours later, those copies get out, they infect the cells neighboring, and that's what starts an infection. So it's if you're maintaining social distancing, if you're not staying in enclosed areas with lots of people where the air is stagnant and potentially harboring this virus, you're doing a lot to mitigate any risk of inhaling it. So say you're out walking your dog and you have a good distance between yourself and other people, there's no real worry to have to wear a mask at this point. The real big worry, and I've seen people do this. I was actually at DIA 2 weeks ago, and I saw individuals wearing masks and wearing them improperly. So even wearing N95, but there was a visible gap around their nose. Or one image that will stick with me for quite some time is a healthcare aide at the living in the state wearing gloves and a mask and carrying a cup of coffee. And all I can imagine is that individual would take off their mask and with their gloves be drinking that coffee, which will go to further potentially infect yourself. So a mask, like Wally said, can give you a false sense of security when really if you're being vigilant and practicing all of these different hygiene and social distancing rules can go a lot further than just wearing a mask and not following these things, of not being mindful of touching your face, of adjusting that mask, of taking it on and off again. As people, we don't really realize how frequently we touch our faces, and it actually becomes rather startling when you become more mindful of that habit.
We just have about 15 minutes left. I'd like to go to a question emailed in. Question is, any plans to give those who have recovered from COVID-19 a certification card that would allow them to travel and work, and thereby helping mitigate the impact on the economy and developing a pool of people who can help others without risk to themselves?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I haven't heard of any plans to to have any kind of formal process for that. I think Catherine had mentioned before that it's still a little early to understand kind of whether or not individuals are at what risk they are for reinfection following a primary infection. And again, it looks like, early indications are that there probably is, some immunity, if not complete immunity, for most individuals. In terms of certification, I don't know. I do think that, when people have experienced the illness, recovered from it, and then are no longer contagious following their recovery. There's probably, you know, assuming again that that this is they're not going to at risk for another infection, or and of course that they're out of the infectious window themselves to be contagious. There's clearly going to be, you know, some roles that they could play with, you know, helping individuals, whether it's just local family, you know, issues with being able to visit with people who need some extra help within your family, or again, volunteer situations. You know, there's a lot of food banks and so on that are really, you know, struggling to staff with staffing, just based upon age demographics and who's at risk. And so I think it's a great concept that as we start to move around this curve and people are sick and recover, you know, that there will be a role for them to play, I think, in you know, helping people get back on their feet.
Well, to that end, the British government, albeit they have changed their tune a little bit in the last couple of days, it seemed like their initial attitude, certainly late last week, was to let the virus just do its thing, let people get infected and then people would recover. I mean, why then would we not let the folks who would not be most at risk for severe complications just get it and recover, and then they would possibly have the antibodies?
Yeah, I mean, that you know, I've heard that. I'm not, you know, there's certainly, I'm pleased that the United States and state of Colorado and county and so on has taken a different approach to that. You know, the danger with that really is you know, about, you know, our healthcare capacity, and even in the UK, healthcare capacity just is not where it needs to be to handle something like this. We don't build hospitals and staff hospitals expecting, you know, pandemics to sweep through, you know, every year. And so, you know, it's really, right, we're doing a lot of this really for those, you know, healthcare workers who, you know, are going to be extremely burdened. We haven't quite hit the panic point here in Colorado. Certain hospitals in New York certainly have. And if, you know, read any reports out of Italy, you know, you'll kind of know what they're dealing with. And Italy has a, you know, fairly, you know, sizable and healthy health system. So we really, you know, the concept of flattening the curve again gets to this idea that, you know, we need to spread it out a bit. And it's not just to spread it out and just prolong the pain. It actually, right, the goal is if we slow things down, we can actually prevent, you know, unnecessary deaths from complications. And, you know, we've heard about shortages of ventilators and things like that. There simply is a limited number of beds and ventilators and our ability to care for people in critical care settings that if we overburden them, you know, there could be on the verge of, like in some Italian hospitals, some of the hospitals are really on the verge of collapse, and they're calling for retired, you know, healthcare workers to come back. They've granted, you know, medical degrees to students who are on the cusp of graduating to get them into the workforce, and we certainly don't want to reach that point here. And I know the UK is probably, you know, rethinking their position on that. It's you know, even though, right, if we let it sweep through and do its thing, right, yes, we could probably argue that it would be over sooner, but I'm not sure we want to be part of that.
Well, we just have just over 10 minutes left with our guests this evening. That was Matt McQueen, the director of the public health program at CU Boulder. He's an associate professor of integrative physiology. Catherine Shives joins us. I misidentified you, Catherine, as a microbiologist. I know you have a PhD in microbiology, but you're a virologist. And Lolly Gardner is with us as well, and she's a certified biological safety professional. And we have lots of questions coming in, a lot of them quite similar, and a lot of it on how do we protect ourselves. But we're going to go back to the phones, and we welcome Steve calling in this evening. You're live on KGNU.
Thank you, ma'am. I want to build on Robert's observations, and what I don't hear at all is nasal maintenance, for instance, and can it be done? I have to blow my nose regularly, and I'm all for washing my hands when I come back from a bike ride or something, but it's not convenient to do when I'm doing what I'm doing. So can you all address the issue of nasal maintenance, blowing one's nose, proper disposal of whatever one's using, handkerchiefs? Am I good? Let's talk about that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Lolly, would you like to take that one?
I'm not sure I'm the right one to talk about nasal maintenance.
Okay, well, anybody else, Katie, Catherine Shives, and this idea that very often, you know, there are nasal sprays that certainly I've used them and they seem to be quite effective if I have like a nasal issue or, you know, some kind of a sinus thing. Is that helpful at all in rinsing out the mucous membranes, I guess, or frequent blowing of your nose? I'm assuming that's what Steve is meaning by nasal maintenance.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, appropriate behavior. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, as a sufferer of seasonal allergies, I definitely feel for you. I'm dealing with this myself right now. So I've entered the part of the year when I am sneezing and having to blow my nose. And for that, you know, definitely I am on the side of disposable. So clean tissues rather than having a handkerchief that may be being handled and used throughout the day. And then when it comes to disposing of tissues, it's pretty strictly straightforward of dispose of them in the trash. Make sure that after trash is handled that you wash your hands. Say you're going out for a bike ride or something like that. As long as you ensure that, you know, you wipe down the bike handles, you know everything you're touching is clean, you have clean tissues, then you can, with a fair degree of comfort, be able to blow your nose and know that you're not introducing the virus to your nose. But once again, I wouldn't recommend a handkerchief that's being handled multiple times throughout the day. And then dispose of all your tissues in a trash stream and just be sure to wash your hands after blowing your nose before touching anything else if you reasonably can. If soap and water isn't available, then hand sanitizer is an excellent option.
Well, thanks for your call, Steve. We just have about 10 minutes left. We have some other calls and callers hoping to get through. But just as we are, I mean, today is a very snowy day. So today probably, possibly would have been a snow day for kids. But we're heading into what would have been spring break. And a lot of kids are already getting stir crazy because they have been inside for a week. Now, we heard earlier on the BBC a report from Spain where they're telling people, do not even bring your children outside. What can we do? Can we go for a walk? Can we go to the park? Can we go for a hike? What is safe when we're dealing with social distancing?
I was just going to say, today's the exception right now. You know, most times getting out in the sunshine, we can do that here in Colorado, and this virus doesn't love the sun. So getting out, getting some fresh air, taking a walk, maintaining, you know, your 6 feet distance between people that you pass, or if you're in the park, you know, maintaining 6 feet between conversations, I would highly recommend it. We're going to go stir crazy if we can't get out and get some fresh air.
In terms of children, though, I mean, it's anybody who has, especially small children, know it's impossible for us to stop touching our faces, let alone kids and putting things in their mouth. So the idea of maybe playgrounds, when we talked earlier about where the virus lives and for how long, plastic, metal, I mean, are those places to avoid and maybe you know, catch frisbee instead or just kick a ball around? I mean, what are some... And these are questions that I've gotten during the day as well from people who are parents and want to do best by their kids, acknowledging that children, luckily, seem to be not as impacted by the symptoms, but at the same time, of course, they can be carriers.
True. Correct me if I'm wrong, virologist and public health professional, but the virus doesn't stay out in UV light very long. It's denatured pretty quickly, as I understand it. So, you know, going to the playground and being out there in the sunshine, as far as I'm concerned, isn't a bad idea. It's actually good for your health to do that. But maybe somebody else would like to chime in on the virus staying alive longer in the sunlight.
Katie, as a virologist, is that something that we can be a little bit more assured about?
Well, there's a saying I've always been a fan of is that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so UV light in sun does actually inactivate the virus. So it's very similar to when you spend too much time in the sun and you get a sunburn. Virus is much smaller. UV rays have a much larger effect on it, and it effectively can kill it. How long it takes to kill, that is another question. So, you know, something that is in direct sunlight, it's baking in the Colorado sun,
I wouldn't be worried about that. But when you have sort of a multi-level play structure that's made of plastic that has sort of dark nooks and crannies on the underside, you know, there's still the risk of contact in that point. So really, if there's a lot of sun, and one thing that we do have going for us here in Colorado is our relatively low humidity. So viruses don't like to dry out. They don't really do well in those conditions. So, but at the same time, you know, we don't really have conclusive data on how long, if a, you know, kid sneezes on a part of the playground that's not in direct sunlight, we don't necessarily know how long that virus will persist on that surface. So at this point, I actually wouldn't give a guideline as to whether or not it's 100% guaranteed that playground structures couldn't potentially harbor virus.
But going for a hike, going for a walk, all of that, it is okay to be outdoors?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So any sort of activity, going out, walking the dog, taking a hike, playing frisbee, baseball, anything like that, with you and your family, yes, absolutely. Get outdoors, get fresh air, get out of the house, and get away from social media and just get some space. And I think that's really important to be able to do that in this time. And, you know, focus on what we can do and being able to enjoy those things, I think will go a long way towards getting us all through this.
And if I could add, and I hate to say this as a news professional, maybe turn off the news sometimes too, except KGNU, because we're trying to bring you informative and hopefully empowering conversations on this. Well, we have just 4 minutes left, and I'd like to thank all my guests for calling in, all the folks who've been emailing and calling in, and not just in this past hour, but really through the day. So many people have questions, so I very much appreciate our three experts. I'd like to give you all maybe just a minute wrap up, you know, your final thoughts and what you would like people to really know and to take away, as there is so much uncertainty. What can you say to folks? We'll go Catherine Shives.
I think my biggest focus in this time is that in times of an outbreak like this, of a pandemic, it really brings home the fact that we are a community and we are all highly interrelated, and what we do as individuals impacts our neighbors. So it is important to, even if you feel like you're a young person and the risks for you are lower than someone, say, over the age of 65, it's still important to do all of these social distancing practices, to have the good hygiene, to be really mindful of these things, because while the impact for you may not be as strong, it could be a critical health, life and death decision for a neighbor, for someone who picks up the shopping cart after you. So I think just really remembering that we are a community and that we need to be thinking of our neighbors at this time is very important.
Catherine Shives holds a PhD in microbiology. She is a virologist and she currently works for Sartorius Virus Analytics as a research and development scientist. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk this evening.
Well, Lolly Gardner, what's your final word? Lolly is a certified biological safety professional with a really long background in this area. What would you like people to take away?
Sure. I second what Katie just said about taking care of others. And I would also just say that don't forget to take care of yourself. Get some relaxation in, get good sleep, get exercise. Socialize. There are plenty of platforms that allow you to connect with friends and family and reach out and do that. Take care of yourself, get fresh air, and also I highly recommend limiting your COVID-19 information on social media.
Lolly, thank you so much for being with us. Matt McQueen, Director of the Public Health Program and Associate Professor in Integrative Physiology at CU Boulder. As a public health perspective, what would you like people to take away?
Yeah, I would echo what both Catherine and Lolly had stated, but also, you know, beyond that, I just, you know, it's really hard to see the benefit of what we're currently doing, because again, there's always going to be this lag. I would just, you know, for those of us watching, you know, closely on the day to day, it can be, you know, kind of overwhelming, but just knowing that what we're doing, has proven to work with this particular virus. It's worked in previous pandemics as well, and to really just to try to process the information, things will get worse from this point forward. We're going to have more cases. We're going to have more deaths in Colorado, in the United States, right? But that's the curve we're on currently. What we're doing now is really to get us to where we want to be in a couple of weeks, which is to start rounding that curve and getting on the other side of it. So essentially, you know, hang tough, hang tight, and, you know, keep doing what you're doing.
Well, Matt McQueen, Lolly Gardner and Catherine Shives, thank you all very much for being with us. And this is part of KGNU's ongoing coverage of COVID-19, but really with a focus on how it's impacting the community, but also in the effort to also connect you with resources and information. And you can find all of our links online at kgnu.org.